All right, I'll start by acknowledging my collaborators. Josh Greenlay, who's here. In particular, Craig Heinke, though, is a grad student at Harvard who's done most of the X-ray talk work that I'll talk about. So I'll start just introducing CVs. This is a schematic diagram of a CV showing main sequence staff overfilling its Roche lobe and transferring material onto white dwarf via an accretion disk. Now, the properties of these objects in the field, they have blue optical colors, they're variable objects, they show flickering, outbursts, periodic variations. They show optical emission lines, and they're moderately bright, fairly hard X-ray sources. Now, initially, people had a lot of trouble finding CVs in globular clusters, but now many CVs have been found thanks to HST and Chandra. Now, here's the non-flickerer, the NF explanation. They're blue, defined by Adrian Kuhl, really, is blue non-variable stars in clusters that are not normal carbon-oxygen white dwarfs. This is an actual picture, conveniently labelled with the square of a non-flickerer. They're thought to be helium white dwarfs, the low-mass white dwarfs that did not undergo helium burning. And these are often found in binaries in the field with white dwarf and neutron star companions. Not that many of them are seen in globulars, but much work remains to be done on that. Just briefly discuss motivation for this work. CVs and globulars almost certainly result from interactions, and just some very rough numbers. In the solar neighborhood, about 0.01% of stars are CVs. It's a very rough number. In globulars, I've found that typically a bit more than 0.1% of stars near the core are CVs. And that's despite having a lower binary fraction than in the field. As for the formation mechanisms, I've got an example here with a neutron star, but you can swap in a white dwarf, which is relevant for this case. You have three or four body interactions, can form them. You can also possibly have controversial tidal capture forming these objects. Now, as for the white dwarf formation, this is the normal carbon-oxygen white dwarf formation cartoon here. We have a red giant that gets brighter. You get a helium flash, moves under the horizontal branch. Eventually, you get carbon-oxygen white dwarf. For a helium white dwarf, any process that strips away the giant envelope and leaves you with the helium core before you get the helium flash will form a helium white dwarf. And again, interactions, as with CVs, are likely to be important. So why study these objects? CVs and helium white dwarfs obviously are good diagnostics of solar interactions, and compact binaries are important for cluster evolution. For example, in this interaction, this escaping star basically converts binary binding energy into kinetic energy. And also a nice thing about these samples is that they're the first known samples of these objects at the same well-determined distance. Well, in quotation marks. So as for a brief outline of the talk, I'll start by talking about core collapse to NGC 6397. I'll talk about HST photometry, and I'll talk a bit about X-rays. And then I'll talk about the uncollapsed 47 tuck. I'll start there with X-ray observations and then talk a bit about HST photometry. Then I'll talk about the FX to FOFT ratios for the 47 tuck CVs compared to field CVs. And then I'll address some general questions and issues. So how do you find CVs in helium white dwarfs in globular clusters? The most important thing to do is to get deep HST imaging and to get deep Chandra imaging. Also, radio data helps because some millisecond pulsars have helium white dwarf companions. So I've got a picture here, HST WIFPIC 2 picture of NGC 6397. I'm going to talk about some of these objects quite a bit. The triangles, the red triangles, we think are CVs, and the blue squares think are helium white dwarfs. So I'll talk a bit about the photometry of these objects. It's a little cartoon on the left of WIFPIC 2 on HST, showing PC1 and then the wide field chips. And if you look at, if you make up color magnitude diagrams of the PC and then the wide field chips in U versus U minus B, there's a bunch of objects, a bunch of blue objects that are only found on the PC chip. They're not found in the wide field chips. So they're interesting, obviously interesting objects, and they must be heavy. They must have sunk to the centre of the cluster by mass segregation. The cluster was centred on PC1. You can see this is the main sequence, and this is the carbon-oxygen white dwarf cooling sequence down here. Now these objects have quite different properties when you look at different colours. This is V versus U minus B, B minus V, and V minus I, so going towards redder colours in this direction. So the objects are all blue in this colour magnitude diagram, but then you go towards the red, the objects labelled with triangles, the CVs, move almost onto the main sequence, so the secondary is dominating the light. But in the non-flickerers, or helium white dwarfs, are very blue objects, and they stay well clear of the main sequence. That's consistent with expectations. But the key discriminant between these two objects is time series. These are time series in U and B, obtained by Adrian Cool. So the time series of the CVs are here, 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 and here, and you can see in each case that the CVs are obviously variable. There's flickering, and there's also longer-term variations, evidence for orbital modulation. And then you look at the non-flickerers compared to reference stars of about the same magnitude, and there's very little evidence for variation. Again, consistent with expectations. If you look at optical spectra of these objects, again, there's a clear difference. Over here is a spectra of the brightest three CVs in 6397. You can see, obviously, Balmer emission lines, and you can see helium 1 and helium 2 emission lines. This is similar to the spectra of CVs in the field. And then this is a spectrum of the fourth brightest CV, showing, again, obvious emission lines. Helium 2, not quite as strong. Now, the NF, or helium white dwarf, optical spectrum looks very different. You don't have, at H beta, you don't have an emission line, you have an obvious absorption line. And if you do some fitting to the parameters of this line, you get values that agree with expectations for a helium white dwarf. So follow-up HST photometry was done to detect fainter populations of these objects. So this is B versus U minus B, showing the four brightest CVs. And then there are four fainter objects down here that are also clearly blue. And this colour magnitude diagram shows R versus H alpha minus R, and the objects are all have H alpha in emission. So that's the CVs. The non-flickerers down here, this is V versus V minus I and V versus H alpha minus R in the PC and the wide field chips. So these are the three bright non-flickerers that I've already talked about, and there's a group of three fainter guys down here. So these objects have H alpha in absorption, the three bright guys, and also the fainter objects. And there are no corresponding objects in the wide field chips. And this diagram shows the radial distribution. This is distance from the centre in arc seconds of the non-flickerers compared to double main sequence binaries and then main sequence stars. So these objects are obviously massive. All right, so we've seen that the CVs are variable. They have emission lines and they're blue. Are they X-ray objects? Got a picture here of a Rosette observation of NGC 6397, showing a whole lot of heavily overlapping sources near the centre of the cluster, and these symbols here show attempts to find optical counterparts. Now, the big improvement, the big excitement in the field recently has been the move towards much better resolution with Chandra. So this is an overplot, showing now that this bunch of heavily overlapping sources are now clearly separated. And the improvement is even more convincing when you compare it with HST. This picture here shows the picture I showed earlier, the WIFPIC 2 image of 6397. These are the CVs, helium white dwarfs. And the yellow circles show Chandra 3 sigma positions for the X-ray sources. You can see this is very convincing. There's excellent overlap between the Chandra positions and the CVs, and there's a another fainter CV that we detected here by looking more deeply at the HST data. The helium white dwarfs, on the other hand, don't show any evidence for X-ray emission. Initially, we thought maybe this source corresponded to the helium white dwarf, but that was not correct. So that's something that was predicted by Hansen et al. The really nice thing about Chandra is that you get, as well as having good spatial resolution, you get good spectral resolution. So this picture shows a color image now of 6397. So the blue source up here is a relatively hard source. The yellow source here is relatively soft. And this is an X-ray CMD now. This is something that's only been possible with Chandra. This is showing X-ray color, just the ratio of the soft to the hard counts. So this is going towards softer sources, towards harder sources, and this is the number of counts. So this bunch of fairly white sources here are CVs, they're fairly hard spectra. And then this one fairly bright, fairly soft source we think is a quiescent low mass X-ray binary. These guys all have optical counterparts. This one does not, to a limit of about 11 in absolute magnitude. This guy is a millisecond pulsar here. All right, so I'll move on to 47 Tuck. Top is a ROSET observation for 47 Tuck. You can see there are heavily overlapping blended sources here. And the circles show various optical variables and blue stars from HST studies in an attempt to find optical counterparts for the X-ray sources. And in some cases it was successful. This number one does correspond to X9. This variable number two does correspond to X19. But you can see the dramatic improvement when you go to Chandra. The spatial resolution now is tremendously improved. You can see you can resolve these sources very easily. There are many fainter sources detected. That's great for finding CVs. I'll show the color picture now. So this is similar for NGC 6397. The red sources are fairly soft, and you can see some sort of blue-tinted objects that are hard. But these two hard objects we found are both eclipsing CVs. They have counterparts with clear eclipses detected in time series. So we think that's self-absorption by the accretion disk. There's evidence that NHing is increased over most of the other sources. And then these are the CVs, these fairly, the objects labeled with triangles, these fairly bright, fairly hard sources. And then these two bright sources here are quiescent low mass X-ray binaries. Now, yeah, you can see the same pattern, that there's a separation between the CVs and the quiescent low mass X-ray binaries. You can imagine a fence separating the two of them about here, and this object is sort of on the fence. It's sort of partway between the two, and there's some evidence that this could be a quiescent low mass X-ray binary, but we classify it at the moment as a CV. There are millisecond pulsars here labeled with circles. They're much fainter, softer sources. These are at the time of the paper, unknown identifications. And then these are chromospherically active binaries, the diamonds. We have a lot more identifications now from more careful work. This is about 2 arc minutes across, if I remember correctly. Yeah. If I get. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are around about 30 CVs in the cluster. Yeah. There actually is another eclipsing one, which I might get to shortly. All right. So I'll show a few finding charts, just as I did with 6397. These are some very generous error circles here, just so this error circle doesn't interfere with the blue object at the center. But these are clear optical counterparts for Chandra sources that we think are CVs. All of these are variable in some way. This one is the eclipsing one, fairly faint. And the astrometric match between the X-ray sources and the HST sources is excellent. It's about a 0.1 arcsecond typically, or even less. So it's fairly unambiguous. But this is an image showing the Chandra image and the field of view of various HST data sets that I've analyzed. This 8267 is the deep Ron Gilliland planet search. And then this data set here, 7503, is deep UV imaging by George Malan. And the nice thing about you can see the different roll angle giving a fairly good coverage of the cluster. And then centered in here is the Christian Kanigi deep STIS UV observation of 47 tab. The small circles are the CVs. These are mostly hard X-ray sources with optical companions. And I also show here 47 tau Q, a millisecond pulsar with an optical companion. There's another MSP optical companion in here. Then one of the quiescent low mass accretory binaries also has an optical companion. Just briefly, the radial distribution of the CVs is indistinguishable from the millisecond pulsars, suggesting they have roughly the same mass. So I'll show some color magnitude diagrams from that planet search data set. So this is U versus U minus V and V versus V minus I. The CVs are labeled again with triangles. V1 and V2 were previously discovered, the counterparts were discovered by Frank Verbund, as was AKO9 has also been known previously. So you can see the same pattern with the CVs in this color magnitude diagram are well to the blue of the main sequence. And then if you go to V versus V minus I, the CVs move over onto the main sequence or close to it. So it's the same pattern as what we saw in 6397. So one useful thing that I've done is to look at the FX to FOPT ratios. I'll give a little bit of background on that to start with. With the observations of field CVs, people have found that there's a correlation between FX to FOPT value and the accretion rate, in the sense that you go to lower accretion rates, you get higher FX to FOPT values. So what I show here are two different figures showing FX on FOPT against V. For nova-like CVs, these are generally high accretion rate systems, and for dwarf novae, which are generally low accretion rate systems. And what I've done to compare with 47 tuck is I've projected the field CVs at the 47 tuck distance. And this line shows a constant luminosity of 10 to the 30 ergs per second. So you can sort of see from this figure that the dwarf novae have generally higher FX to FOP values than the nova-like CVs. Sorry? No, I'll get to that. Yeah, it's all the field. All right, so this now compares 47 tuck with the field objects. This is sort of a complicated plot. There's sort of the whole shebang plotted in here. But the CVs are labeled with triangles, so they're mostly in here. There are other various classes of weird objects. But the only CV found below 0.1 in FX on FOPT is AKO9. This is an eclipsing CV with a subgiant secondary and probably a fairly high accretion rate. You can see that there are, just qualitatively, there are differences between the 47 tuck FX on FOPT values and the field objects. And I do that more rigorously here, showing the cumulative distribution of FX on FOPT for the 47 tuck CVs, shown with this thick line, compared to various subclasses of the field CV. So DQ HER systems, UGEM dwarf novae, and SU UMA dwarf novae. In each case, the field CVs have smaller effects on their FOP values, suggesting lower accretion rate, higher accretion rate, sorry. So I've wondered if this is a real effect. You know, is there some sort of systematic effect that could be biasing the observations? And I don't really think that there is anything. One way to look at this is to think about, is to see whether there are any field CVs in this part of the FX and FOP figure, and there really aren't any. There aren't any objects up here. It should be pointed out that I also show in this figure X5, it's the optical companion to a quiescent low mass X-ray binary. And up here, the similar FX and FOP value is the V3, the object that I said was in the fence. It had sort of an intermediate hardness X-ray spectrum. So that one could also be a quiescent low mass X-ray binary. But I don't think there's significant contamination of these objects from quiescent low mass X-ray binaries, because these are most of the quiescent low mass X-ray binaries don't have any optical companions, and the limits on FX and FOP are up here somewhere. And there's also clear differences between the X-ray spectra. So possibility is that this is some evidence for different formation. Sorry? Yeah, there's no counterpart to a fairly deep level on that. I can't remember. It's over 100. It's well above the top of the figure. And in 6287, it's a similar. I think it's a similar limit. So one question, another question is: are a lot of the Golgi cluster CVs magnetic? This summarizes the evidence. This is the figure I showed before, showing fairly strong helium-2 emission lines. And this figure compares the 6397 CVs with field CVs. So this is plotting absolute magnitude of the accretion disk and also the continuum ratio between H-beta and H-alpha. This is basically a measure of how blue the star is. And down here, I show the ratio between helium-2 and H-beta equivalent widths. So this is going towards stronger helium-2. And I do this in several classes of CV. And the dwarf novae generally have very weak, they're all plotted here, they have very, very weak helium-2 lines. But if you compare up here, what I do is I just do a simple fit to the distribution for DQ Her systems, or intermediate polars, and the 6397 CVs lie very close to that fit at the sort of low accretion rate end of the figure. So that's suggestive of the objects being magnetic CVs, but a lot more work needs to be done to make that convincing. In 47 Tuck, there's not a great deal of evidence for the CVs being magnetic. V1, one of the brightest CVs, does show an X-ray periodicity at 218 seconds, which we interpret as intermediate polar or DQ Her behavior. AKO9, another eclipsing CV, in the UV has a similar spectrum to GK Per, and that's GK Per is a magnetic CV, so that's another piece of circumstantial evidence that some of these CVs might be magnetic. That's interesting because only a fairly small fraction of field CVs are magnetic, something like 10%. So it could again be a sign of interactions.
More like 25%.
25%?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'll show a little bit of the Krishnan-Kanigi data set. This image shows a far UV image of the central part of 47 Tuck, and this figure shows a U-band image of the same field. And the yellow circles are the X-ray source positions. And you can see, first of all, the crowding is much less of a problem in the far UV image than even in the U-band. You're only picking out objects like blue stragglers or CVs or white dwarfs for the most part. And you can see, it's a little bit hard to see, but V1, AKO9, V2 and W15, all CVs that we saw with Chandra are detected in the far UV. But the trouble with this data set is that the field of view is very small. This is the picture I showed before, showing the small field of view. This is a zoom in showing four CVs here, and this is a millisecond pulsar companion here. A number of these X-ray sources are probably chromospherically active binaries, and a number of the other ones might be millisecond pulsars. So four previously reported CVs are detected in the UV as blue and variable objects, and they're plotted in this UV color magnitude diagram. So here's the white dwarf cooling sequence. Here's the main sequence turnoff, horizontal branch, and blue stragglers. And here are the CVs, AK09, V1, V2, and W15. And Knigge et al. Argued that perhaps some of these other stars between the white dwarf cooling sequence and the main sequence were also CVs, but they don't appear to have X-ray counterparts yet. Nice thing about this data is that UV spectra were also obtained, but I won't show that. I think some of them are likely to be non-flickerers, and we'll look at a deeper HST data that we've got to test that.
Maybe that scale rug is actually 15 magnitudes on your color axis, and 8 on the luminosity, and the radio color.
Yeah. It's very sensitive data. I mean, it's sort of a very deep core sample of 47 Tuck in a sense. But the field of view is, you can see that most of the CVs that I've detected are well outside the field of view of the STIS field. In fact, of the roughly 103 sources found in this field, only 20 or so are inside this field of view.
We can't read the
subscripts
on your
M. This is MFUV, so this is the far UV magnitude minus the U magnitude, roughly, M336.
What is it?
It's a far UV. It's I show the spectrum of. That shows the rough spectral coverage. Right. I'll talk just briefly about a helium white dwarf that we have in 47 Tuck. This is a millisecond pulsar companion to 47 Tuck U. This is a U and V image. This is a radio error ellipse for a millisecond pulsar. This is the Chandra error circle for the X-ray counterpart. See, the star is clearly blue. These are color magnitude diagrams, V versus U minus V and V versus V minus I, showing the object is fairly close to some helium white dwarf cooling tracks from Serinelli et al. This is a definitely a non-flickerer. The time series is very, very uninteresting, apart from the fact that there is a weak signal in the power spectrum at the radio binary period, confirming that the blue star is the companion to the millisecond pulsar. Now, there are several other helium white dwarfs inferred from radio observations, and I'm guessing Fernando Camillo will talk about that. All right, do some comparisons between the two clusters. So this is showing, the 47 Tuck is much brighter than 6397. The collision frequency I use from Pooley et al. Collision frequency for 47 Tuck is much higher than 6397's. It has a much bigger core radius, is the main reason. So this shows the number of CVs. This is CVs with luminosities above 10 to the 30 ergs per second. It's about 30, allowing for incompleteness in 47 Tuck and 9 in 6397. Now, the number of helium white dwarfs, I've talked about 6 in 6397, but this number 1 here is only the optical companion. I mean, there are bound to be many more in 47 Tuck, but there's been no systematic search, and that's obviously required. I also showed the main sequence binary fraction. This is from Albro et al. Paper. So Raja has a number that's slightly lower. And then this is for a main sequence fitting. So you can see 47 Tuck has more main sequence binaries and relatively fewer CVs if you scale by the collision frequency. So it seems to suggest that NGC 6397 has converted more of its primordial binaries into CVs, perhaps during core collapse. That was, I took it straight from the Pooley et al. Paper. It was the scaling using the central density and the core radius. I think the people use different values to scale that, so it's somewhat up in the air. All right, I'll talk about future observational work that is important in the field, one thing is to search for the very faintest CVs, especially in 47 Tuck where we're less complete. And the HST work, the Chandra work that I talked about was based on 74 kiloseconds of observations. Now we have a 300 kilosecond data set that will go much deeper and should find much fainter objects. Pulsation searches in the optical and X-rays is something that's important for magnetic CV searches. One obvious gap at the moment is the lack of searches for helium white dwarfs in 47 Tuck. And we have new HST advanced camera data with H-alpha imaging, which will be very useful for finding fainter helium white dwarfs. More orbital periods are needed for CVs. At the moment, we have four periods for the CVs in 62987 and about 7 or 8 in 47 Tuck. Radio velocity studies are also needed, but they're for both CVs and helium white dwarfs, but they're very challenging because the objects are very faint and they're very crowded. So it's difficult to do the job with HST because you run out of signal to noise, and it's difficult to do it from the ground because the crowding is very bad. And also, finally, more complete millisecond pulsar searches in 63.97 are important for looking at the neutron star numbers. Thank you. Roseanne.
Well, this is more in the way of a comment than a question. Because when you first were, or one of your first transparencies, you mentioned the formation mechanisms, and one of them was the three and four body interactions, and the other was the one with the question mark next to it, which was tidal capture. And you know, I just want to make a historical comment, really, because back in about 1992, at that point, it was considered well understood that three and four body processes would not make CVs in globular clusters. There's this wonderful paper on binaries in globular clusters where I guess Pete is the first author, and Steve was another author. You know, all the big names in binaries and globular clusters. And one of the puzzles that was raised was that why don't we find CVs? They're hard to find, but we're not finding them in globulars. And basically there was a little paragraph that explained that, well, you know, two-body tidal capture doesn't work, and you know, three and four-body processes don't make them because it involves the exchange of a light. It would involve the exchange of a lighter object into the binary. So at that point, Saul and I did a set of calculations using two-body tidal capture, but making some corrections for the cases that were unlikely to survive, and that predicted fairly significant numbers of CVs to have been formed in the central regions of globular clusters. And then for years, when people continued to fail to find them, the story was, well, that sort of proves that two-body tidal capture doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Now that they're being found, I think it's important to, you know, go back and think that, you know, one needs to do the kind of integrated calculation of two, three, and four-body processes, and some of that has been done. I know Melvin has this great paper on the binary zoo, and, you know, you really want to do it all together to genuinely see what two, three, and four-body processes do. But, you know, historically, it really was the two-body tidal capture, having made corrections for some of those cases when you might not, you know, you might worry about whether it really works, that actually was responsible for the predictions. And now it's nice that CVs are being found there. Hmm. But
yeah,
I think maybe the question mark should be the other way around. I think that would be the way I would put it.
Hmm. Well, an observational point on that is that people made claims about there being very few CVs based on detections of outbursts. And corollary of the stuff that I've shown you is that if these CVs have very low accretion rates, even lower than SU UMA systems, then the recurrence times for outbursts might be very long. I mean, there are something like 30 CVs in 47 Tuck, but only a few outbursts have been seen.
I mean, I think to continue from Roseanne's point, I mean, one should, if one's going to go through this kind of exercise, you're also going to emphasize the fact that you probably want to look at multiple generations of exchanges as well. I mean, if, for instance, I was struck by your binary fraction of 47 Tuck and 6397. I mean, one of the other things I didn't talk about was you can ask, well, what is the most stable binary you could make if you take the central densities at face value? And if you make it, you can always make it tighter to survive against exchange, but if you make it too tight, it's going to spiral in by gravitational waves. And so for 6397, we got that basically the longest lived compact optic binaries were only giga year old, whereas for 47 Tuck, it was 10 giga years. It was a very. So it's likely that those two clusters have very different histories in terms of how many exchanges that the surviving objects have gone through.
Yeah, and hopefully, I mean, the helium white dwarf populations might be quite different. That's something that I'm keen to look at myself.
Okay. How do you expect
That was how does can you restate the question?
Well, you're saying that there's a systematic difference in the X-ray to optical ratios for field CVs to the 47 Tuck, and suggested maybe that they were formed in a different way and that would affect the mass accretion rate.
Well, most people in the room would agree that CVs are formed in a different way in clusters compared to the field. But I don't have any decent explanation for the accretion rates being different. So that's sort of a last resort type argument. There could also be a combination of stronger magnetic fields for the white dwarfs and low accretion rates. But that still doesn't really explain what causes this. Well, another possibility is that you're seeing, you've got this sample of objects all at the one distance, that you're seeing a more representative sample of CVs in clusters. I mean, there are predictions that in the field, there are many faint CVs that, lower accretion rate CVs that are being missed by surveys. So maybe we're looking very deeply with Chandra and HST at the one field, and we're picking out a more reasonable number of these objects, but I'm not sure that that's the right explanation either. Simply because there are some of the CVs in 47 Tuck that have higher FX to FR values than any of the field CVs.
Can I ask a question? Once you've made a CV, then it's in this fairly high density environment. And has anybody estimated how that affects the lifetime of the CV? Because in a sense, it's continually being hardened. Not by near collisions, but by accumulation of distant encounters, rather like a dynamical friction approach. Does anybody estimate whether that would significantly shorten the CV? Because after all, it's transferring mass one way, and every hardening it gets, it loses a bit more mass.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of interactions will kick the system out altogether. So that's one possibility. But I don't know, Roseanne, have you looked at that issue?
You know, there's a paper by Paul Joss and that does this in a very simple way and sort of just shows what happens when you have these epochs of enhanced mass transfer along the lines that you're suggesting. But maybe somebody else is aware of something more detailed that's been done. Clearly it's an important issue in both that and the knocking out of the CV. It shows how important this issue of linking the dynamics together with the binary evolution is along the lines of yesterday's discussion.
No other questions? Thank you.